Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Oh, we're going to be in 1 Kings 5 through 7. I don't know how in the world we're going to do that. But I think as we see a broad outline and we see the general purposes, and I try to give you some books to help you fill in the details if that's what you're looking for, in this discussion of Solomon's building projects. I'm going to try to give you an outline as I go through. It's outlined in the notes you received from me, and maybe that'll help us kind of work through this massive amount of technical material, much of which is very difficult to sort out specifically. Now, as far as Solomon's temple, there are several places that we can see it in the scriptures. First of all is this 1 Kings 5 through 8. And then we have 1 Chronicles chapter 17, 21, 22, 28, and 29. And then 2 Chronicles 2 through 7. And this is all the material we have to work with to reconstruct this. We have found archaeologically some very similar patterns in Canaanite, Phoenician, and Syrian temples. And it seems like that what Solomon did was take some from the tabernacle, the pattern given by God, and of course David was revealed to by God, and the plans of the temple are basically divinic, though the workmen are from Phoenicia. And this working influence is probably where the Phoenician and the Syrian influence came in. And so we're going to try to reconstruct these building projects. We know that he started in his fourth year, took him 7 years to finish the temple, 13 years to finish his own palace and house. So building was a real major part of Solomon's whole reign. Many think he just wanted to be like other Eastern potentates, and that may be true. We just can't be certain about a psychological motivation. But early, he seems to have loved God very much. Let's begin then, if we could. Now, Hiram, king of Tyre. We learn from Meander of Ephesus that he was 19 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 34 years. There's been some different hair pulls about the date. Some would say he began to reign in 978 and reigned to 944, a 34-year reign. Albright says he started in 969 and went to 936. There's also, from this meander, the implication that he gave his daughter to Solomon as one of his wives, and that may be true. Now, that Hiram and David were good friends, we see that in several different places. Let me see if I can find that reference to you. 2 Samuel chapter 8, excuse me, chapter 5, verse 11 is one of them. Now, he heard that David had died. He sent a note to Solomon, said congratulations. And what we have here is basically Solomon's letter back saying thank you and I need this from you. There's a much fuller account of this in 2 Chronicles 2, chapter 3 through 10, and you might want to look at that. Notice in verse 2 where it mentions about his David, my father, was unable to build. We learned that was because he was a man of wars. We see that in 1 Chronicles 22, verses 8 and 9, and 1 Chronicles 28, chapter 3. Hiram had already built David's palace, we see from 2 Samuel 5:11. Now, the plans, David basically planned the temple. He began to collect material. He developed the worship service, the Levitical singers, all of that. And we see this planning, basically it was said it was given by God, just like God gave the plan to Moses, he gave the plan to David. And there's much similarity between the tabernacle and Solomon's temple. Solomon made it twice as big, but the basic pattern is there. Now we'll see 1 Chronicles 22, verses 2 through 5, and 1 Chronicles 28, chapter 2. This idea on verse 3 about under the soles of his feet, that's a Hebrew metaphor for victory, and you might want to see that. Now verse 4, God gave him rest. Now this means it's a metaphor for no wars. He had time to do other cultural things, building things. On every side, and there is neither adversary or misfortune. Now in 1 Kings 11, we're going to talk about some adversaries, basically Hadad of Syria and Rezin. And these seem to develop later in Solomon's reign. You might well see 1 Kings 11, verse 14 and 23. And, of course, they're mentioned in 1 Kings 19. Elijah is supposed to anoint them, although Elisha will do it. Now, notice what it says in verse 5, and I intended to build a house. You might want to see 1 Chronicles 28, 1 and following, for where God gave the pattern to that. And let's see. Notice in verse 5 really has a lot of... Well, it's kind of recalling 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 12 and 13, and of course 1 Chronicles 22, 8 through 10, where God promises David to build him a house, a dynasty, where David wanted to build a physical house for God. It's kind of a play on the words there. Now notice in verse 6 is the allusion that no one knows how to work with wood like the Sidonians. Now, of course, this is Phoenicia. Tyre and Sidon kind of changed places, the chief city, but This is the Phoenicians. They built their houses out of wood, their ships out of wood, and they were, of course, workers with wood. In verse 7, Hiram seems to bless Yahweh, but this is very common. It doesn't mean that Hiram was a follower of Yahweh. We think he was a follower of Baal. But he blesses Yahweh, which is common in a lot of this ancient correspondence between these kings. Notice there in verses 9 and following, basically, this whole first chapter is verses 1 through 12 is a preparation for building the temple. And here in verses 1 through 12 is talking about the materials that are going to come from Hiram, king of Tyre. Let's see. Notice they're going to cut the logs in Lebanon, float them down the Mediterranean to a place where Solomon directs. We learn from 2 Chronicles 2:16, this is the seaport of Joppa. Notice it says, "You shall accompany my desire by giving food to my household." We know that the Phoenicians, particularly Tyre and Sidon, were dependent on Galilee for foodstuffs because there was no land to grow crops. And so the Phoenicians were seafaring people, but they had to depend on food for Israel. It mentions some of the food here, about verse 11, about 20,000 cords. When you add all this up and you compare it with chapter 4, verse 22, for Solomon's needs, the court of Hiram was about one-fifth less than Solomon's, and that might be interesting. This little book called Ancient Israel, there's two volumes. This is volume 2, Religious Institutions. The other one is Civil Institutions. It's paperback, very helpful. We'll tell you about what a kor is. My New American Standard in the margin says one kor equals 10 bushels, but all the measurements and weights are in this little volume and its companion. It'd really be helpful for you to have. Notice it mentions then, beginning in verse 13, of the second part of this outline, preparations for the temple, chapter 5, verses 1 through 12, is about the materials from Hiram, king of Tyre. And then, in verses 13 through 18, we talk about the laborers. How is he going to do it with manpower? Now, notice in verse 13 it says, "He levied forced laborers from all of Israel." You might want to compare this to chapter 9, verses 15 through 22, where it says he didn't make slaves of the Hebrews. Well, what he did, he made slaves of the Canaanite populations that David had conquered. And then the Hebrews were in a three-month rotation system. These particular ones were 1 month in Lebanon and 2 months back home. Now, this is what he did to the different tribes, the different men of the tribes. He also used several other peoples. If you notice, it mentioned verse 16, we have the foreman. Now, there are different ways of adding this number up. From chapter 9, verse 23, it says there's 550 more supervisors. So if you add 550 to 3,800, 3,300, you get about 3,850. Well, that fits pretty well if you compare 2 Chronicles chapter 2, verse 2, and 2 Chronicles 10:8. You still get about 3,850, but different way of counting these same men. So there were about 3,850 Israeli supervisors over this task. Then notice in verse 17, it talks about cutting stones. And, of course, the people who cut stones best were these Galabites. Now, we know them differently, probably as the city of Byblos. We get the word Bible from that meaning book. You might want to see Joshua 13:5 and Ezekiel 27:9. It mentions these huge stones. We're going to find them later in chapter 7, verse 10, were something like 17 feet by 20 feet. They were absolutely huge. This is white limestone. You could cut it with a saw, and then after it weathered, it got hard. But the reason we have no example of this architecture is this white limestone could burn. It wouldn't actually burn, but it would go into powder, and that's why all this was destroyed. Now, let's look then at chapter 6, and if you're following my outline, Roman numeral 1, be Yahweh's temple, chapters 5, 6, and part of 7, number Roman numeral A, preparations, chapter 5. Now, Roman numeral B, construction, chapter 6. Now, I want to read a little bit out of this Roland DeVoe for you about the structure of Solomon's temple. Listen to what he says. I'm on page 313. "Moreover, the text is full of technical terms and has been disfigured by scribes who understood it no better than we do. And it has been loaded with glosses meant to enhance the splendor of the building. Lastly, not one stone of this glorious building is to be seen today. Our only guides are the text, where the exegesis is often uncertain, and the comparisons which can be drawn from archaeology of Palestine and of neighboring countries. It is not surprising that the reconstructions which have been attempted differ considerably from each other." And that's so very true. We can't reconstruct Solomon's temple. Now, I want to show you the two places I think give you a good idea. This is the New International Version, and this is a picture at 1 Kings 5 of Solomon's temple. And I think this is an excellent little diagram. It's one of the better ones that we can get. And I hope you'll look at the footnotes there. Another excellent source is the Zondervan's Pictorial Bible Encyclopedia, Volume 5, Under Temples. And it shows the floor plan of Solomon's temple and a possible reconstruction. And this seems to be one of the better reconstructions that I have seen. So if you want a more detailed picture, there's some excellent pictures in the children's Sunday school posters that show Solomon's temple that's very much like this in color. And so if you can get to your church archives and find those past children's things, you can find a picture of Solomon's temple that's very good. This is an excellent detailed article in this Zondervan's Pictorial Bible Encyclopedia, and I hope you'll look at that for further references, okay? Now let's look at it if we could. Let's start the outline off with verse 1 of chapter 6. It says, now it came about in the 480th year. Now the Septuagint says 440 years. Now this is a way that many people use to date the Exodus. We know pretty much when Solomon began to reign. He began to reign somewhere around 966. So his fourth year is about 965, something like that. Now I want to show you two different books here because to show you kind of the hair pull about this. This is the Encyclopedias this is the Encyclopedia of Bible Difficulties by Gleason Archer. And he has an extensive article, just page after page after page, on the accuracy of 1 Kings 6:1. He would date the Exodus 480 years before Solomon's reign, around 966. Now, and he backs that up with all kinds of information. It's so interesting. If you're a conservative Bible teacher, you need this book because it deals with all the controversial passages in the Bible. Now, another man that I like very much that takes an opposite view is John Bright in his History of Israel, beginning about page 113, where he takes an opposite view that this is a symbolic number representing generations of 40 years, and that archaeological data has more of the 1290 B.C. instead of 1445. And so this gives you the other side of the question about the date of the Exodus. Personally, I'm just uncertain of what to believe at this point, and I'm going to wait for more information. I certainly believe the Bible, but many times the numbers are symbolic, and we take them so literally mess up. And archaeology seems to have some very good evidence about a 1290 date for the Exodus. But here's these two volumes if you're really interested in that. And the crux of the battle is 1 Kings 6:1, so I hope you'll look at that. Now, notice then, beginning in verse 2, so B would be construction. Verse 1, date. Now, the floor plan is seen in verses 2 through 10. And by the floor plan, I mean the basic layout of the building. It's been very interesting to me that this long rectangular with one end being opened, and it faced east. And in this long rectangular were three major sections, a 10-cubit vestibule, a 40-cubit holy place, and a 20-cubit holy of holies where the Ark of the Covenant sat. And on each side were storage rooms, apparently 5 cubits, 6 cubits, 7 cubits, 3 stories tall, and they were up against the building. Now, this is very interesting. We found some patterns like this in some of the archaeological studies. And when you see this threefold pattern in your mind and look at some of these supposed floor plans, like in the NIV Study Bible and in the Zondervan Pictorial Bible Encyclopedia, it'll really help you kind of visualize this thing. And notice, if you would, it gives us the length and height. We're not sure exactly what a cubit is. The Hebrews use parts of the bodies to measure. And a cubit is from the longest finger to the elbow of a normal man. But we found 3 cubits. First is the standard cubit, about 17.6 inches. And then is the royal cubit, about 20.9 inches, which we think the temple is based on. And then there's a long cubit, about 21.6. And so you can see there's a lot of confusion about exactly how big this is. Most of us assume it's the royal cubit. Let's see. I want to say again to you, we have two sources to understand this. Number one is the tabernacle, and number two is these archaeological discovery of Phoenician and northern Syrian temples that help us a whole lot. Notice that in verse 7, the stone was to be pre-cut. Now, these quarries were close to Jerusalem. We're going to find the stone came from Jerusalem, the lumber from Phoenicia, we would call it Lebanon today, and the iron, the brass, is going to be cast in the Jordan River Valley close to Succoth. Now, notice here that they're going to pre-cut it. So it just slips into place. So somebody say, why was that? Maybe because of the silence of the place, because it's holy, or to make it fit better. We're just not sure. It doesn't say here. Now, there's been a real controversy among scholars about what the winding stairs mean in verse 8. Many think it means trap door. Some say just stairs. I think this picture in the Zondervan's Encyclopedia does best It's showing one side entrance only. Exactly how the stairs look, we're not sure, but that seems to be the best. Notice that he's going to cover it all with cedar planks in verse 9. That's very interesting. We found that archaeologically in other ancient temples of this period in this part of the world. And these wooden planks were not only for decoration, but they had a part of the structure of holding the masonry in place. And I think that's extremely interesting. Now, notice in verse 11 through 13, here we have a very significant, another part of the outline would be the covenant condition. This is Yahweh's temple, and Yahweh is going to put the conditions here again, over and over. It's if you will, I will connection. And I think that is extremely interesting, and you can see that there. Now, beginning in verse 14, if we could, notice we're going to get into some of the design details here. Mostly, it's the inner aspects of how they're going to build each room. It starts with the Holy of Holies in verse 16, where the ark would dwell. Then it talks about the inner sanctuary overlaid with gold. It's a cube of 20 cubits square, which means the roof had to be lowered a little bit because the height of the rest of it was 30 cubits. Or some said it was a storage area above it. I'm not real sure. The roof is never talked about in here. It's overlaid with gold. We're going to see there's some symbolism here. The closer you move into the Holy of Holies, the closer where God dwelt symbolically above the wings of these cherubim, we move from bronze to silver to gold, somehow representing holiness or closer to God. Not exactly sure. Now, notice these huge cherubim mentioned in verses 23 through 28. These are not the cherubim on top of the Ark of the Covenant. These are two huge ones, 10 cubits, 18 feet tall, that face the front door, and their wings cover the Ark. This is kind of the resting place of Yahweh's feet on earth. It's amazing. You might want to see 2 Chronicles 3:13 for them facing the door. What is a cherubim? Well, some say it's a guardian, going back to Genesis 3:24. Others say it's a representative of heaven, holiness. There's no real certain symbolism here. Let's see. We hear of all the carving, and you can read this. The divider between the Holy of Holies and the holy place is discussed in verses 31 and 32. It was made of olive wood. It's a very beautiful thing. Then in chapter 6, verse 36, let's see. Turn too fast. We see something of this inner court. And that's the only place it's mentioned here, though the inner court's mentioned of Solomon's palace down in chapter 7. There was an inner court for the temple, there was an inner court for Solomon's palace, and an outer courtyard that encircled both of them. And so the king's palace was connected to the temple in some way. Let's see. Let's go to chapter 7 then. Now there's kind of a break here. Chapters 7, 1 through, let's see, about... 1 through 12 is going to deal with Solomon's palace. We're kind of breaking in the context. We talk about Hiram and the materials and the workmen. Then we talk about the basic structure. Then we kind of break away for 12 verses in chapter 7 and talk about the palace of Solomon and Pharaoh's daughter. And then we come right back at the end of chapter 7 and talk about some of the metal work in the temple. So it seems a little out of logical order for us, but I guess we can let the inspired writers do what they want to, can't we? Now, about Solomon's palace. That's in chapter 7, verses 1 through 12. Let me kind of outline it for you. The date is given in chapter 7, verse 1. Took 13 years. We've seen that before. The parallel would be 2 Chronicles chapter 3 and 4. Then the floor plan is given in verse 2 and in verse 6. There seems to be several structures being spoken of here. First is Solomon's house called the Forest of Lebanon. Must have been beautiful. Secondly, is the Hall of Pillars. Third, is the Hall of Judgment. And fourth, is Pharaoh's daughter's quarters, verse 8. And they're kind of mixed together. We can't have enough detailed information here to really reconstruct that at all. And so we have to kind of leave that rather tentatively. Now, the foundations are mentioned in chapter 7, verses 9 through 11. And we think that the temple was built on a 6-cubit-high foundation, and probably Solomon's palace was on this kind of foundation. Notice it mentions jewels and costly stones. It must have been absolutely gorgeous. And then the outer court is spoken of in chapter 7, verse 12. This outer court would be where all the people meet on the three major feast days, like Passover and Day of Atonement, those kind of things, back in Leviticus 23. Now, in chapter 7, verse 13, we're back again to the metal working of the temple. Now, it's going to be in three divisions. First, we're going to have Hiram, who really, his name is not Hiram. He's not Hiram, king of Tyre. If you compare 2 Chronicles chapter 2, verse 7, and verses 13 and 14, His name is Huram, H-U-R-A-M, dash Abi, A-B-I. So don't get him confused with Hiram, king of Tyre. And this guy, we learn from verse 14, he is also basically Jewish. Now, he grew up in Phoenicia. His father was a Phoenician. He probably learned his trade from his father. But his mother was Jewish. She is from the tribe of Naphtali, but lived in the city of Dan. And so here again, like the tabernacle, God chose a special man of the Jewish people to design the tabernacle, be an artisan. Well, here we have an artisan who basically is also Jewish, who's going to design the metalwork for Solomon's temple. And so we see the man himself in verses 13 and 14. Okay, now, let's begin then, if we could, the things that he built. Now, first of all, we have these two pillars. And you might want to see chapter 7, verses 15 through 22. Now, these things are monstrous. They're two bronze pillars. There's been a lot of theorizing about that. Some say they're a handbreadth, this right here, and that they were hollow. They're 20 feet around and something like 23 feet tall, 23 cubits tall, along with a 5-cubit cap, a very ornate cap on top. Well, someone said, what does that mean? They're even named in the Bible. Look at verse 21, Jochen and Boaz. Well, some say it stands for David and Solomon. Some say it's an acrostic for a phrase we don't know any longer. Some say it symbolizes, because of Phoenician background, these two words, strength and stability. Some say they were meant to be smokers, because in verse 41, it seems to say they were like a bowl. Some meant they would have an incense on top and would smoke all the time. Some say like the Shekinah cloud of glory. Others say they're traditional stele, like the Canaanite temples, but they were monsters, beautiful things. Let's see. What else can I say about them? The tops were so ornate. They were just I think they stood out front. They either were freestanding, like the Canaanite temples, or they were held up this porch, this vestibule that was the entrance. We're just not sure. Now then, in verses 23 down through, let me find my notes again, 23 through 26 is this thing called the sea. Now we learned from 2 Chronicles 4:6, it was for the priests to do ritual washings in. It had its counterpart in the tabernacle, the laver. But this was much huge, 30 cubits across, 10 cubits high. Some say it held something like 10,000 gallons of water, 2,000 baths, Hebrew measurement. And then again in verse 27 through 39 is another strange thing. It's these 10 portable washing basins or water containers. They're so heavy, you wonder how anybody ever moved them. But there were 10 of them. Their design is also structured here. All of this bronze was built at Succoth, and we learned that. Let's see if I can find the place. Getting ahead of myself. Slow down, Bob. A summary of all this is found in verses 40 through 45. So if you look at 40 through 45, it kind of outlines most of the stuff. There's one thing left out that's in 2 Chronicles, but you can find that for yourself. In verses 46 and 47 is where they cast these things. And it was in the Jordan Valley and used traditional methods. Archaeology had pretty much confirmed that there was a bronze working place found there. Now, verses 48 through 50 is interesting. We move from the bronze work of Hiram to this gold work. Now, the gold work basically has several things, and most of this is at a holy place. We have the incense altar. We have the table of showbread. We have the lampstands. Now, one lampstand was in the tabernacle, and I think it's a beautiful thing. Back in the NIV study Bible on page 484, it shows a picture of this incense altar, lampstand, portable basins, and you might want to get this NIV study Bible. It'd be very helpful to you, particularly on technical things like this. Now, in Solomon's temple, there's not one with 7 points of light, but there are 10 of them along the holy place, 5 on each side. We know there were windows at the top, but I guess this was to do something to have light at night. And then there's the final thing in verse 50 is a lot of incidental things like spoons and censers and dippers and shovels, all made of gold. And that's in verse 50. Now, finally, in chapter 7, verse 51, we have the things that David had dedicated to the temple, things made of different kinds of metal, gold, silver, and other kinds of metals. And Solomon brings those things of David into the temple. Now, we learn about these things that David built from 2 Samuel chapter 8, verses 9 through 12, and 1 Chronicles 18, verses 7 through 11, and 1 Chronicles 29, the whole chapter. So we kind of get an idea of the large amount of things that David prepared beforehand. But we learn from 1 Chronicles 29 that David had already collected 100,000 talents of gold, 1,000,000 talents of silver, 3,000 of the specially fine talents of gold, and 7,000 of the specially refined talents of silver. So a huge amount of metal came from David and the taxes that he had, the levies on foreign trade. And then, of course, we learn from other parts of the Bible that Hiram, king of Tyre, sent thousands and thousands of talents of gold to Solomon during this period. I know this is somewhat confusing. I hope you'll read through it again and look at these special sources I've given to you, like Ancient Israel by Roland DeVoe, the Zondervan Pictorial Bible Encyclopedia, and the excellent footnotes in the NIV Study Bible. Well, I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week.